Welcome to Frankly Speaking, a production of George Mason University. The streams begin high in the mountains of Virginia, the hills of Maryland and Pennsylvania. They run through green farmland, picking up pesticides and fertilizers, through suburbs gathering dirt from construction sites and heavy metals from road runoff. They pass through cities sweeping away sewage discharge, and they deposit it all in the Chesapeake Bay. The bay is dying. Unless the destruction is reversed, it will soon be unable to support either marine life or the birds, animals, and fishermen who depend on it. Growing awareness of this is leading to action. A three-day conference on choices for the Chesapeake will be held at George Mason University from December 7 to 9, co-sponsored by the governors of Virginia, Maryland, and Pennsylvania, the mayor of the District of Columbia, the Chesapeake Bay Commission, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. I'm Helen Ackerman, and with me to talk about some of the bay's problems is George Mason University Assistant Professor of Biology, Robert Jonas. Dr. Jonas is working on a research project on the development of low oxygen conditions in the bay. Bob, what's really happening to the bay? Is the bay dying?
Simply stated, no. The bay is not dying in the sense that all life will disappear from the bay. What is happening in the bay is that man's influences, that is anthropogenic impacts on the bay, are leading to large-scale changes in the flora and fauna of the bay. The fish populations are changing, the submerged aquatic vegetation is either changing or in fact is being eliminated from the bay, and the zone of low oxygen conditions, or true anoxia, that is, no oxygen at all, which may be natural in the bay, is increasing dramatically, apparently under the influence of anthropogenic impact.
So what you're saying is that if we don't do something about what is affecting the bay is going to really change radically.
Exactly. The bay will be altered so greatly that our commercially harvestable finfish and shellfish resources will be reduced markedly, and although it will still be available as a essentially an open ditch for the transport of materials on the water, it will not be a very useful resource as far as the biological life sciences are concerned.
Certainly doesn't sound very attractive
mere
ditch.
It does not.
Has anyone identified the major culprit in the deterioration of the bay?
That's a rather complex scientific question. There have been implications of some of the major problems, and one of them revolves around the sort of so-called eutrophication, that is nutrient enrichment of the bay. Increases in the concentrations of nitrogen and phosphorus in the bay and in the sub-estuaries, that is the feeder streams into the bay, areas particularly in the northern part of the bay and in the Patuxent, the Potomac rivers, and in the James and the York rivers in Virginia, are showing high concentrations of nutrients, at least seasonally.
Now that comes from farmland, right? That's the superphosphate, the fertilizers that the farmers are using on their lands?
That is one of the sources. Obviously other sources would include domestic wastewater coming from sewage treatment plants, but runoff from forests and pasture land also contribute to this problem. One of the major impacts, however, would be that from cropland itself.
What would you see then as the biggest need regarding the bay to bring its deterioration under control?
Well, as regards the eutrophication or nutrient enrichment, it appears that two courses of action are probably worthwhile. That would be where we have water in a pipe that we can actually get our hands on, an industrial source, or a wastewater treatment system, that we have technology for actually removing the nutrients and reducing the concentrations that are going into the water. Where we have so-called non-point source pollution by these nutrients, that is runoff from farm fields, we can include the possibility of green strips around the edges of the farm fields to reduce not only nutrient losses with the water, but to reduce sediment losses into the bay. and sedimentation of the bay appears to be one of the significant impacts, which is also occurring.
When we talk about nutrient impact, you're really talking about the growth of algae, right?
Basically, the problem which is developing from all of this and my interest in the low oxygen conditions revolves around the fact that when the nutrient levels increase in the water, and if we have sufficient light intensity, which is required for all plant life, that the single cell algae that we call phytoplankton proliferate, they grow and duplicate and produce blooms, bloom conditions, very high concentrations of these organisms. They subsequently die and sink in the water column, where the microheterotrophs, that is the bacteria and the fungi, decompose them using up the oxygen in the water column. Now, under the conditions that occur in the bay, particularly in the mid-bay regions, where there's essentially a stratification, that is a layering of low-density water over a high-density area.
And that's to do with the salinity of the water.
That is related in the bay to salinity and partly to temperature changes, so that in the summertime, there is a lack of mixing of water from the surface to the deep water. The oxygen gets used up by the processes of these microheterotrophs. And subsequently, when the oxygen is reduced to some critical level, organisms begin to either leave the area. And one of the examples of this appears to be the so-called crab wars, where the crabs actually leave the water and run up on the beach when they are in the presence of very low oxygen conditions. Or the water may actually go anoxic, and organisms simply die in place. And so the benthic, or the bottom flora and fauna, the organisms that live in the sediment, who cannot survive without oxygen, will succumb.
Mm-hmm.
So organisms such as the oysters, where periodic anoxia occurs, oysters simply cannot grow any longer. One of the sort of anecdotal bits of information about the bay is that in times past, oysters were harvested from areas as deep as 40 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And today, oysters are not harvested below about 25 feet. And the implication is that the anoxic conditions keep them from regrowing in the deep water. Though that is hardly proven, it is indicated.
So there is a suspicion that at one stage the water was much more aerated than it is now.
Well, that's not just a suspicion. That's hard fact. We can show that. As early as around 1938, people observed low oxygen conditions and anoxia in the deep waters of the bay. But today, we believe that the volume of water is some 15 times greater. The volume of water, which is anoxic, is some 15 times greater than it was then. And this appears to be a natural proclivity of the bay. The bay has a tendency to do this. And by increasing the nutrient concentrations in the phytoplankton production, we have exacerbated the problem. We have pushed it along its natural course of history.
Bob, we're talking about a very large and complex body of water that varies considerably from its shoreline to its middle and depending where the streams come in and that kind of thing. Do we really understand how it works as an ecosystem, or can you even develop a concept of it working as an ecosystem?
Simplistically stated, no, we don't understand it. That's hard for scientists to say. We have certain ideas, certain models by which we think we can understand some aspects of the bay. But in fact, the bay is just a tremendously complex hydrodynamic system. The water flows come not only from the rivers that feed it, but from the ocean under the tidal influences. The bay has a dual circulation with salt water flowing along the bottom in a northward direction, fresh water flowing along the surface in a southward direction. And we don't exactly understand the hydrodynamics, let alone the biology and chemistry of the system. One of the other problems we didn't mention before regards toxic substances in the bay. One of those would be heavy metals, and heavy metals are dramatically influenced by the chemistry, the water chemistry in which they exist. Consequently, things change markedly as we go down the salinity gradient to the open ocean. So we're looking at a system that's essentially mountain freshwater, cold streams, running all the way to warm seawater, at least in the summertime.
Is it even realistic to think that we can reverse this trend?
Yes, I think it is. I think that morally and practically we have a requirement to go ahead and try to do what we can. Technically, it is within our capability to go ahead and remove nutrients, phosphorus and nitrogen species, or to pattern our land use activities so that we can optimize the removal of these influences, these human impacts, or that we can in fact tie them up, hold them in place, and keep them out of the system so they don't have the impact. It is technically feasible, but it's going to cost some money. And therein lies one of the serious problems with all environmental problems today, is that where do we get the money to deal with these problems? Basically, the public has to accept the proposition that this is an important resource, that it is being degraded, and that it is important for us to put some of our resources into this to maintain both the water quality and the living resources of the bay.
Is there anything that could be done that would have an impact fairly quickly and fairly cheaply? Obviously, it wouldn't provide a complete solution, but would be something that could be done to help the situation.
Well, I think that as far as some of the treatment technologies for working with the nutrient inputs, as I said, green strips around farm fields or along the edges of the feeder streams could be accomplished relatively inexpensively, but it would require some considerable amount of coordination among political jurisdictions to encourage farmers, for example, to leave green strips around their fields. This might take the form of a tax incentive, for example, that might encourage them to do this. I hesitate, I'm not a policy person by training, and I hesitate to suggest the kinds of expensive technology that would be necessary for doing some of these things or to force people to do them. But I think that if people understand what's causing some of these problems, that we can, at least within our technology, go ahead and try to treat them.
Do you think there's enough basic research being done on the bay?
Well, obviously from my point of view, no. I'm a scientist, and my interest is in the role of heterotrophic microorganisms and the phytoplankton in developing this anoxic zone. I don't think we understand the system well enough to make firm statements about what the causes and effects are and, in fact, what we can do about them. One of the reasons for the upcoming conference is to take the information we know now to make our best judgment about what we should be doing with it. But at the same time, they have included a section on what they call monitoring, which does include research into the processes that are going on in the bay. What kinds of biological processes are going on? Why, in fact, are some of the fish species being reduced in numbers? We simply don't know. We have some ideas and we have lots of information, but we certainly don't have the whole picture.
There does tend to be a general human tendency to want to maintain things as they were when the nature of the thing is to change, and water bodies are, I would imagine, one of the things that was most likely to change. Do you think any of these changes would be taking place anyway without man's interference?
One of the things about the bay, one of the characteristics, is that it is in fact a nutrient trap. Nutrients don't flow through the bay like they flow down a river. And this is a natural process of estuaries and lakes, in fact, where sediments and nutrients get short-stopped in place. And over the long-term history, the ultimate fate of all lakes is to be filled in and turned into swamps. The bay, in fact, might occur in the case of the bay, but it would be a very long-term process. And what we have done is hastened the day massively by orders of magnitude.
Dr. Jonas, I want to thank you for explaining some of the issues involved in saving the bay. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking, a public service program produced by George Mason University. My guest has been Dr. Robert Jonas of George Mason's Department of Biology. For information about our guest or this program, please call 323-2138. Our technical assistant is Donna Ambrosiano. I'm Helen Ackerman at George Mason University, the State University in Northern Virginia. Thank you for listening.